Support for WPR comes from the National Eagle Center in Wabasha, Minnesota, offering daily eagle programs, summer river cruises, and guided habitat tours. More information is at nationaleaglecenter.org. Support for WPR comes from Rutabaga Paddle Sports, offering canoes, kayaks, and advice to experience solitude on Wisconsin waterways. With test paddling at 2620 Rimrock Road in Madison. RutabagaShop.com.
Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mealer here. And you know what? In case you haven't noticed, the outside is now the new inside. Many people are enjoying their yards more by adding living space outside. And we're going to be talking about some of the trends and answer your questions about enhancing your yard here on Garden Talk. And our guest today is Joe Kressel. Joe is a landscape architect and the owner and president of Hawks Landscape in Wauwatosa. He won many landscaping awards in his 40-plus years in the business and certainly can help you with your landscaping questions. And we'd love to hear from you, of course. Considering adding a patio or other outdoor garden feature? Do you have a difficult landscaping problem? Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. Joe Kressel, welcome. Thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you. Glad to be here.
You've been working in the industry for a long time, and Hawks Landscape has been around for 150 years.
Yeah.
That is
it's a
rare.
Long time.
That's rare. How'd the company get started?
Well, it started actually in Rochester, New York, in 1875. That's 1 year before Custard's last stand at the Little Bighorn. And shortly after its inception, one of the owners, there were three owners at the time, and one of the owners is originally from Wauwatosa, Wisconsin, and they opened up a branch in Wauwatosa. And the first farm was a 20-acre farm at 59th Street. There was 20 acres between Wisconsin Avenue and Blue Mound. And that went on for many years. And then they bought another parcel at the corner of 91st and North Avenue, and that was 40 years. And it grew out to be a pretty large operation. There were over 400 salespeople in the early days working for Hawks Nursery, and they were salespeople across all of northeastern United States. And plant material would be shipped out in the spring and fall, bare root and crates, and then they would go to on the railroads to various locations. And salespeople would, you know, walk door to door trying to sell plant material.
Oh, my goodness.
And oftentimes the salespeople were the postmasters of small towns. And they all had this beautiful sales book that we had. And the sales book had some of the first color photos. And so people would be blown away by seeing color renditions. Actually, they were colored plates. They weren't actually photographs at the time, and people would be blown away by the color and of the plant material and be very excited.
So that's things have changed a bit over the years.
They have changed and dramatically in many ways, and then in other ways not so much. We've got some letters from one of our salespeople that in 1894, and he was the sales rep for Walworth County. And he would talk about his Monday letter back to the home office, and he would talk about what it was like being a salesperson and selling plant material and how high-quality plant material and the good commissions that he would earn and stuff like that. But he would also talk about the weather and how the weather affected and the late spring and early springs and late falls and lack of snow in the wintertime and, you know, all the things that we worry about today.
Yeah.
He had the same issues. But one thing that was a little bit different was he would talk back to the younger salespeople that they would go from farm to farm on horseback. And at the end of the night, wherever they ended up, they would always expect him to go back on his horse and go home. But this one gentleman, he said the best way to sell plant material is to walk from farm to farm. And at the end of the night, you'd always get a nice warm place to sleep in the barn on some beautiful smelling hay. And then in the morning at the breakfast table was the place to sign a contract. And so it's changed. We don't do that anymore.
Oh, so do you grow your own plants yet?
No, we gave up growing probably in about 95, 96. The property, we originally, where we're currently located on Watertown Plank Road, we originally had 38 acres there, and now we're just down to 8 acres. And we're at 122nd Watertown Plank Road, which is very close to Elm Grove. After World War II, the business kind of changed a little bit. It went through a lot of transitions over the year with the Depression. And during the Depression, we became more of a local, regional nursery versus a national sending plant material to the East Coast and stuff like that. Everything became much more local, and that's when we start doing landscape design and construction a little bit more. Actually, the first landscape architect that ever worked for a nursery worked for Hawks Nursery back in 1926. And he claims, and I met the gentleman, he was 100-some years old, 102 years old.
Oh,
I met
goodness.
Him in 94. And he was very proud of the fact that he graduated from Harvard, and he was very proud to say that he was the first landscape architect that actually worked for a nursery. And prior to that, it was two different professions. It was landscape architecture and landscape construction or installation nursery type work. Yeah.
But you've combined that with your business, Hawks Landscape. We have,
and we've gone through a lot of transitions as well. I purchased the property or the company in 93, and immediately it's a long story, and I won't go into it, and trying to acquire the business, and I started managing in 92, but when we finally put everything together, the buildings that we were purchasing were being condemned by the city, so we had to build a new building, and we built a new state-of-the-art garden center, and we had a lot of different divisions. We had, you know, 5 or 6 different divisions. We had a florist and arborist and chemical applications, and pretty elaborate. Well, we found over the years that was it was more profitable for us to be really good at one thing.
Yeah.
And so we rent our space to Steins now, and they operate a garden center of our property. And then we dropped the arborist work and the chemical applications and the floral business. And now we just strictly work with design and construction and maintenance.
Design, construction, and maintenance.
Right.
And just do that well.
And we do it really well, I like to believe. It's much easier for me. And it was part of my retirement plan, too, to scale down and not have so many things going on.
Well, here you are, a landscape architect. And, by the way, a degree in landscape architecture from the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Correct. And this is my 50th year working as a landscape architect.
So how has your job changed over time, in terms of the landscape side of things?
You know, I'm really lucky. I've got wonderful employees that I work with, and I've got a chief operating officer and who pretty much runs the business now.
Mm-hmm.
And I can just do what's fun for me. And and what's fun for me is designing landscapes and selling landscapes. And I still get involved in the management of the company, but I am able to do a lot of things that I just love doing, and that's landscape design.
And speaking of that, I think the interest in that, I think, has picked up considerably over the last 5-10 years.
You know, you're correct. You know, people are looking at more highly maintained landscapes. They're getting more extensive, and people are spending more time living outside and living outdoors. And you know, it's kind of changed over the years too. And people are looking for the outdoor living room that we always talked about. Well, the outdoor living rooms are now have kitchens and fire pits and everything else.
And those have become a fairly popular addition, outdoor kitchens, for example. I mean, you think about Wisconsin, there's a lot of the time of the year you're not going to be able to use it, are you?
You know, I thought the same thing for years. I go, outdoor kitchen, not here in Wisconsin. You know, everybody, you know, was promoting those years ago in California. They were, you know, really picking up in the southern states on the East Coast. And I thought, oh, nobody will ever want an outdoor kitchen in Wisconsin. Well, I was wrong. I have one myself, and my wife and I just love it to be outdoors. You know, you come home from work in the evening, and instead of sitting in the kitchen, you know, we're together outside and being in a space with the birds tweeting and you know, life all around us, watching the plants grow and flowers blooming. It's really wonderful. And you know, in the past, you know, my wife would be busy in the kitchen and I would be watching TV or reading or doing something else, and we wouldn't be talking. There wasn't conversation. And now when we're outside, we're full of conversation. You know, we talk, and you know, it's great for every relationship. It's wonderful.
Our guest today, Joe Kressel, a landscape architect and owner and president of Hawks Landscape in Wauwatosa. It's great to have him with us. And we've been talking a lot about the history of Hawks and just started talking about the landscape side of things, and looking forward to hearing from you. Question relating to landscaping, I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. Something that, an issue maybe with your own design, your own landscaping, or maybe you want to try something different, give a call. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Great to have you along for Garden Talk here on WPR News. Coming up at the top of the hour, Diana Offuth will be back to help you get the most from your summer garden, the vegetables and the flowers. So we'll talk with her about that at the top of the hour. Right now, we're taking a look at landscaping with Joe Kressel, who is a landscape architect and owner and president of Hawks Landscape in Wauwatosa. Have you had some work done through Hawks or maybe another company? Questions, give a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@wpr.org. Jake emailed with a question, what's an outdoor kitchen other than a grill? And that kind of leads me into my next question, which was, what kinds of things you consider when adding an outdoor kitchen?
You can make it just like your kitchen indoors, you know, really. Our kitchen that we have at our house is got two grills. It's got a big green egg, which is kind of a smoker, and plus a gas grill that's, you know, hooked up to natural gas. And then we also have a refrigerator. We have a sink with a faucet, and then we have cabinets and a drawer for trash and garbage and paper towels and a place to put all of our grilling tools, you know, different various drawers and compartments. And we don't keep any food necessarily out in any of the cabinets, but you know, you're afraid of varmints.
The squirrels coming in.
But we do keep the refrigerator full, and it works out great.
What are and I'm thinking about all right, you've got those appliances and all those features. They're going to be sitting on something, paving material, I assume, of some sort. What are paving materials that are good for patios?
You know, there's so many options. There's so many options, and it's really, you know, dependent on the budget. And it can be as simple as compacted gravel to concrete, concrete pavers, clay pavers, natural stone, wood decks. There's so many different opportunities, and it all depends on the situation and you know, what the grades are and what the budget is, because the more exotic the materials become, the more expensive things become.
Yeah. Just to go along with that, Katrina emailed to say the previous owner of her house covered a lot of surfaces with river stone. And the fact of the matter is the weeds are coming up through the river stone. And what's the best way to keep the weeds down that grow through this? And what should probably have been done ahead of it so that that wouldn't have been the case?
Yeah, you know, weeds are inevitable in landscapes, and they're really tough to control. If somebody put river stone around your home, they probably put it over a weed barrier like DeWitt or Typar. And one of these fabrics, they're kind of a semi-permeable fabric. They do keep the amount of weeds to growing up through from the soil. However, after years in weed seeds and debris fall in between the rocks and create another soil on top of it, and the weed seeds begin to grow, and you're going to get weeds no matter what. The best, easiest way, well, not the easiest, but one of the best ways is to just pull the weeds. They can be treated chemically with Roundup or Roundup-type products like a razor or other products that control weeds. And then there's organic products such as vinegar is oftentimes used to control weeds in planting beds. You got to be careful with all the chemicals that you plant, including the vinegar, that you're not burning your plant material and that you keep it well enough away from the leaves and branches of the plant material so you're not killing it. In Canada and a lot of European countries, they ban chemicals like Roundup, and everything is done mechanically or organically. And so gardening is kind of an art, and it does take time and energy.
What are they, when it comes to planting material, what are some of your favorites for patios?
Well, trial and error, I've learned a lot of lessons over the years. And one of my things that I used to do is I used to like, oh, we'll put really showy plant material around the patio. Like service berries, which are just gorgeous. You know, they have the beautiful early blooms, and then they have the little berries that are the size and taste of blueberries with a beautiful, you know, autumn, fall coloration. It's really a multi-seasonal plant. But unfortunately, it is messy. When those little berries, you know, fall onto your patio and stain it, if you have limestone or some white kind of material, concrete, they'll be staining it, and then the birds just flock over it, and they eat all the berries, and then they defecate on the patio and your patio furniture. So now I've kind of changed my attitude towards that and try to stay away from the berry-producing plants and the messy plants and try to keep things as ornamental and showy as possible. Oftentimes with annual flowers, hydrangeas, plant material that gives you a lot of color is the most fun.
Ralph emailed, can you give an example of something you've done in a small backyard? What's the least amount of space that you've had to work with?
Oh, smaller spaces are some of the most fun spaces to work with because there's so much you can do. You know, you can make a very intensive landscape in a small space that sometimes people with large spaces couldn't afford to do because of the scale. Because the scale is small, you can use really high-end materials. You can create really lovely spaces. And some of the best work that I think I've done has really been with small spaces. And, you know, you do a lot of bordering. You do curbs and the planting beds. You know, you might have a patio that you might do a brick curb around. You can use bluestone and, you know, a lot of natural materials. And you know, maybe, you know, where you might... in some situations, try to create an evergreen or a plant material fence. You might go to a very highly designed, well-designed fence and soften the fence with plant material in front of it, but to gain privacy. So creating unique and interesting shapes. And one of the things that in designing patios that I always like to make sure, and sometimes people, they don't think of furniture. And how are they going to use the patio, and where are they going to put, you know, the table, and how big is the table going to be, and how many people do you want to entertain? And these are all things that you need to consider when you're designing any space, but mostly when you're designing a small space. So really working in the furniture and designing what furniture is going to be in your space and how you're going to use your space is really important to understand that on the onset, so that you you don't end up with a space that is all traffic pattern and you can't use it because you're just going from one space to the next. That's one of my biggest pet peeves when I see things that are poorly designed.
I'm thinking about that. If the furniture is too big for the... and you've got too many tables or whatever, mm-hmm. you're suddenly...
you got to draw it all in right in the beginning. You know, it's something that it's got to be part of the design to begin with.
Let's talk about that whole process for a minute. For those who might be interested in, we've been thinking about a patio. What happens when somebody calls Hawks to get an estimate on an outdoor project? What's the...
Well, you know, it's call in. One of our architects and designers would typically call back. And sometimes, you know, especially in the spring, it might take a week or two before we're able to get back to you, because we do get a lot of calls early in the spring and early summer. And then, you know, a designer, architect will meet at your house and discuss your project. Typically, you know, over the phone, try to discuss what... you know, what your needs are and what you're looking for, so that we can, you know, align you with the correct proper person to, you know, to handle your design challenge. And then someone will come and meet at your house and discuss budget. You know, budget is one of those things you should keep in mind. How much do you want to spend on, you know, and how elaborate, and how do you want to use your property? There's a lot of questions that a designer is going to ask you, and there's a lot of things that go in to making a good design. How is the environment? Is it windy? Is it exposed to a lot of sun? Is there a lot of shade? Are there walnut trees above it? There's a lot of environmental factors that we have to consider when designing a space. And so... knowing kind of what you want the space to do for you and is very important. So talk it over with your spouse and come up with a general idea of what you'd like to do.
Yeah, and probably have a set of questions.
Right.
For the
designer that comes and helps you out, and then we'll go back and design it and discuss budgets It's a process.
It's interesting to me because not long ago I was talking with a guy who does his company does interior design and fixing restoring or somebody's kitchen what needs to be redone or something like that, and he has his process is design. Build.
Sure.
And it sounds like that's, and in his case, they design, a company or a homeowner would hire him to, or ask him for design, and he would very discuss this.
Primarily, that's what we do as well. You know, yeah. we don't do bid work. You know, or, you know that you know, big commercial projects. Primarily, we focus on residential design build, but we also do, you know, more. You know, several years ago, I redesigned the Alverno College campus. You know, so we get into bigger designs where, you know, the campus was just a mess. It was all filled with parking lots and there was no circulation. And it was just, they were adding one building after the next. And so we redesigned the circulation throughout. We got rid of a lot of the parking lots, turned it into playing fields and soccer fields and ballparks and built up parking structure, which accommodated the parking and made the campus so much more beautiful instead of looking. And now it looks like a college campus versus a, you know, a drive up community college that you.
That was done to some extent. A guy by the name of Al Fish was a manager here at the UW-Madison. And he did a survey of the amount of parking spaces.
At
surface, no, at,
oh.
at the UW-Madison,
oh, yeah.
And the surface parking was huge amount of space being taken up, and then you got all these cars not looking so good anyway.
Remember Lot 60 before the medical complex? That was massive.
But did the same thing, and when new buildings would come in, the parking would go underneath, or there would be a parking structure that took up a far less space and allowed for, as you're talking about,
well, and just beautification, and you know, it creates a more friendly, welcoming environment to walk amongst landscaping and. Beautiful walkways and vignettes. It changes your life.
Vicky emailed to ask what shrubs are good for a privacy screen. It's full sun to part shade.
You know, traditionally, you know, viburnums are always a very good option for screening. However, right now they're challenged. We've got a pest that's viburnum beetle, and it's chewing on the leaves. And so you're going to have to use a systemic on them if you plant many of the viburnums, with the exception of prunifolia, black haw viburnum, and maybe I don't see too much of it on the Korean spice viburnum. But dogwoods are good. Red and gray dogwoods are great. There's for flowering displays, you know, in the sunnier locations, bridal wreath. And one of the things there was a sales book that was published in 1932 by the sales manager of Hawk's Nursery, and he always promoted bridal wreaths by Rita and privet. Make all your hedges bridal wreath and privet. That's for flowering type plants. And then there's some hydrangeas that get pretty big nowadays that tolerate some shade, and like the Limelight hydrangeas gets 8 feet tall, and that can create a nice buffer. It takes a little time to grow up. It's a little slower growing, but once it gets there, it creates a really nice buffer. For the ultimate privacy, there's viburnums, or there's arborvitas that are great. And they'll tolerate a little bit of shade. I especially like
grandiflora.
There's some of the arborvitas are so subject to deer damage. And depends if you're in an urban area and you don't have a lot of deer, then you can use whatever you want.
We are talking today with Joel Kressel, landscape architect and owner and president of Hawk's Landscape in Wauwatosa. It's great to have him with us. Questions or comments or maybe an experience to share, I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. Brian emailed, what are some good options for outdoor lighting for an outdoor space? That's all, in this case, already been designed and built, but is underlit.
You know, it's lighting has evolved so much over the last 10 to 15 years. It used to be that the only best option and good option was line voltage. And by, you know, just lighting fixtures that would be similar to ones that you would use in your house. And line voltage is still its outstanding choice for lighting. You get the most watt of light when you're, and you have the least amount of problems. Sometimes when they had those old Malibu lights, the low voltage lighting,
they were
awful because there just wasn't enough voltage going through the line and the connections would always corrode and it was always going to be problematic and you're constantly changing the little bulbs. Well, now we have lighting that's much more, it's much better. The low voltage lighting nowadays is incredible. With you get a lot more lumens, or they're shooting out a much brighter light, and there's a lot of color changing lights. There's so many options, and it all depends on your budget. But proper lighting, you gotta put enough lights in so that you have enough lumens, and that's all something that you need to discuss with your designer to make sure that we have enough lights. Mm-hmm. Larger trees in the, I'll put 3 lights per large tree to illuminate the canopy. If the tree is like 18 inches or in diameter or larger with let's say it's a maple tree and it's got a large overhanging canopy, I'll have 3 lights in that. Smaller plants, if I'm lighting, doing an uplighting, I'll have 2 lights. And then naturally you want to have path lights. And one of the things that you have to be considerate of is that you don't want to illuminate it so much that you're scaring away your neighbors and that you're making your house, you know, too bright. And so most of the lighting in the low voltage range of lighting is indirect lighting. And the lighting shoots down on the ground to illuminate the ground and then it bounces back. And or it shoots up into the trees and reflects back down to illuminate the space. But you shouldn't be looking at any hot spots of light. So the key is to have all your lights and the bulbs actually screened. LED lights are the lights that we're using right now in the low voltage lighting. And we've really gotten away from doing the line voltage, except on possibly commercial sites we're still doing it. But line voltage, all that we're doing is pretty much LED, and it gives us all the light that we need. I love using in retaining walls and steps, I love using the step light. And the fixtures are so small that you can barely see them, you barely notice that they're there, but then you get a nice illumination that will drip down the face of the retaining walls and will illuminate steps so that you can go up and down. So there's a lot of things that can be done with lighting, and it's a lot of fun. I love lighting.
Yeah that's I mean, you're creating a really nice picture in my head when you were talking about that wall.
At my house I have color changing lights, and so I change the themes to reflect the holidays. So at Christmas time, they're all flashing red and green, which saves me a lot of time setting up Christmas lights in the wintertime. I'm not having to go out there and get my fingers cold. And, over the 4th of July, I just had them red, white, and blue. And, you know, I did that Memorial Day. And then for Valentine's Day, they're all red. And St. Patrick's Day, they're all green. And, you know, it's kind of fun.
I'll admit that I do the same darn thing. Oh, man. We had a question from or comment from Paula in Winnicottie. Hi, Paula.
Hi. I have a question about dwarf Alberta spruce trees. I have two on opposite sides of the house, west and east, and they are about 10 to 12 years old, always been healthy. Last winter, it seemed like they got really, like, must have been winter burned.
Yes.
The one on the east side is more protected, and it seemed to overcome it in the springtime and has budded out and looks okay. The other one is half brown still, and I tried pruning back some of the dead branches and basically looks skeletonized. Is there anything I can do, or is it just done?
You know, it's that's a tough question because there's not a good answer, quite honestly. It's going to take a very, very, very long time for it to grow out. If the holes are small areas, you can, you know, they'll grow out in 4, 5, 6 years. If it's the whole side of the plant, it's probably, you know, take it out and replace it. Last winter was an awful winter for a lot of reasons. We had so little snowfall in southeastern Wisconsin, I know for sure. A lot of very, very cold weather. So the roots weren't protected. We had extremely cold weather, and then we'd have real warm periods. And then real warm periods, it would warm up the plant. The plant would get excited and start drawing water up, and then it would get real cold again. And then the sun would come along in the spring, and it would shine on the plant, and it'd burn the plant. And so we had so many factors environmentally that made last winter a really tough winter on plant material. I saw it on a lot of trees. Silver maples even this year were very delayed in leafing out because of the harsh winter. Plants that you normally don't see. Hydrangeas are much smaller than they typically are this point in time. So with your plants, if you want to do it again, I would recommend that you cover it in the wintertime because it's really, in Winneconne, it's really a kind of a semi-hardy plant. It's not the hardiest of plants.
Makes good sense. Paula, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Joe Kressel, our guest from Hawks Landscape in Wauwatosa. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Great to have you with us for Garden Talk on WPR News. Coming up at the top of the hour, we're going to be talking about the vegetable and the flower garden with Diana Alphus. So we're looking forward to that coming up at the top of the hour. Right now, we're looking at landscaping. How about sort of some landscape, an outdoor living space for your area, for your backyard, perhaps? You ever do one in the front yard?
Yes. Yeah.
I wondered about that because most of the time I see them there in somebody's backyard. Oh, by the way, our guest is Joe Kressel of Hawks Landscape in Wauwatosa.
You know, front yards have been, you know, part of, you know, for a long time, you know, everybody had, in the old days, everybody had a front porch, right, mm-hmm. with the rocking chairs and everything. Mm-hmm. And that was, you know, and people still...
I still have one, by the way, and I love it.
Yeah, it's great. So, a lot of people, the activity is on the street. If a lot of homes have maybe a sunny side of the backyard might be really shaded, and the front yard is sunny and in the afternoon, or maybe has a western exposure, and people want to sit out in the front of their house, and because that's where the activity, and they want to watch the people walking up and down the sidewalk or whatever, and so we do front patios all the time. It's in smaller lots, you know, like you might find in Whitefish Bay, and you know, I've done several of those. That's a common thing.
Even with not a lot of space in the front, you can do something.
Well, you know, you're maybe not going to put a barbecue and you know, and all that stuff up in the front, but certainly make a sitting area, a place to sit and you know, watch the world go by. It's great.
Well, I love my front porch.
Yeah.
That's for sure. I even have a refrigerator strategically located just inside.
So can you reach people, in and get something
people,
to drink?
People right. come by, and every once in a while, somebody will stop and talk, and then, well, maybe we'll have a beverage while sitting on the front porch, and I don't have to run to the basement.
That's very smart. Very smart.
I wanted to talk about fire pits, because that's something that a lot of people have or would like to have.
There are more and more fire pits, you know, or people are asking for them. And you know, when you think about it, fire pits have been around for a long time. You know, Native American Indians, you know, they sat around the fire. And there's something, you know, that regenerates the soul, I think, sitting around a fire that is really exciting and really good. And Jens Jensen, you know, back in the mid-1900s, really, maybe was one of the landscape architects that promoted the council ring and the, you know, the experience of sitting around a fire pit. And, you know, he had one that he built in the clearing in Door County that was very popular. And today it's just growing and growing. And you know, I can speak from personal experience, you know, just like the outdoor kitchen, we go out to the fire pit almost every night and sit there. Now, there's so many different types to do it.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because you've got, well, in the first place, you've got solid in place or you've got portable.
Well, there's, and the price range can go from, you know, less than $100, you know, way up to thousands of dollars. And it all depends on how you want to use it and how, you know, what are you going to be burning? And so on the portable end of it, there's small fire pits that will burn wood that will be, you know, quite portable. And I know Weber has one, and there's a Solo, or I can't remember the name of exactly, that's a nice little fire pit. And I've had clients where we've created like a council ring with just some boulders and put one of those Solos in the middle of it. And it's been, you know, that becomes their fire pit. There's also ones that are like tabletop fire pits that are propane that are portable, that might be a coffee table that converts into a fire pit. You take the lid off of it, and then it's no longer a coffee table, and you use it as a fire pit. And then it just goes on to wood burning fire pits and made of all different materials, and even fireplaces are also somewhat common, depending on the location and where you want it. I think the top of the line, and it's what I have at my house, and a lot of my neighbor saw what I was doing, and now my neighbor has one too. It's a gas fire pit, and it's so easy to use. It's connected to the gas line of your house, and runs off of natural gas, and you can adjust it, and you don't have to have carry in wood, and you don't have the mess of ants and all the little, you know, animals that kind of nest in the wood pile. And it's a much cleaner way to have a fire pit, and it's instant. You just turn it on and you have fire, and when you're done, you turn it off, and it's very nice. There's very little risk of, you know, burning embers, catching your house on fire, or anything like that. So the codes are much more lenient with gas-fed fireplaces, where wood-burning fireplaces sometimes, or fire pits, are more restrictive with codes. But then again, you know, the wood-burning fire has a nostalgia of the smell of burning wood, and it creates a real warm sensation as well. So it's just a little bit more work, but considerably cheaper.
Yeah, considerably cheaper, but I was instantly thinking about the fact that the smoke always seems to be blowing right straight in my face, no matter where I move around the...
you know what's kind of neat about the gas fire plant is it keeps the mosquitoes away. And we find that this winter, you know, even there was, or this summer rather, it was just like a few days ago when it was like in the 90s, we had the fire going in the fire pit, and only, you know, we kept the fire very low, but the gas flames kept the mosquitoes away, and we didn't have any, and you know, we just sat there and watched the fireflies.
Well, what are the most, I you know, you've been doing this a long time, are there, what are the kind of the best trends in your mind, or the most popular trends of the last 5-10 years?
Oh, gee, that's tough. You know, I think one of my favorite trends is you know, the trend that's probably old as time, and that's using natural materials. Mm-hmm. And for me, natural materials, natural stones, natural things that are found, you know, in local quarries and local fields, and clay bricks, to me, is by far the best way to go. I like natural materials over, you know, concrete products. So I think that's one of the old trends that I like to promote as a new trend as well.
I think that's great. How has business been for you?
Sensational. Yeah, we're real busy. Yeah, it's been a lot of fun. It's been a good year.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. Is Cynthia emailed, I should have brought this up. What kind of difference can a well-designed outdoor space make to a home's resale value?
It makes a difference. You know, it makes a difference. You know, it in terms of curb appeal and the way the house looks. You're not always going to get 100% of your dollars back when you're landscaping. It depends on the condition and the type, but you're going to get at least 50% of your investment back when you sell the house, and sometimes 100%. It all depends on the condition of the house, the condition of the existing landscape, but it certainly is going to draw traffic to your home, and it's going to maybe get you in a situation where you get in a bidding war with other homes that are for sale, and because your home looks better. And curb appeal is one of the number one things that people look for when selling a home.
I was thinking about my own situation. The home I bought, my daughter was little, or 5 years old, and I wanted a back lawn space that was big enough for her to kick a soccer ball around, and a two-car garage I could put a basketball hoop on it so she could shoot baskets. Now, she's gone.
Yes, no more basketball hoop.
And now I'm looking at that back lawn, and I wonder if it happens in your line of work, that people say, you know what, maybe it's time to put in a back patio.
You know, I think you're onto something, because that happens all the time. I think, you know, early on when in people's lives, you know, you're focusing on your children and raising your children, and then once you're the empty nester, and that's when I think a majority, and that you focus on the interior of the house first when you move into a home.
Yeah,
oftentimes, and then as time evolves, it seems most of our customers are more mature. They've been living in their house a while. The home interior is done, and now they're kind of tired with the outside, and they want to improve it.
Yeah, well, I've been pondering that and wondering, well, if I did that, the next person who came maybe with young kids might not want it.
Well, they might want it. You know, it certainly might sell the house quicker.
If there's any realtors listening, I am not planning to sell my house anytime soon.
don't call.
Don't call for that. Well, it's been a real pleasure talking with you today, Joe.
Pleasure's all mine.
So much fun, and hope we have a chance to do this again. Hope we meet down the road again and do this. Thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Larry. My pleasure.
Joe Kressel, he's been doing this a long time, landscape architect and the owner and president of Hawks Landscape in Wauwatosa. I just received an honor from their local community for their work. So that's kind of We didn't get into that, but it's kind of a nice to know that here's a company that's been going on for 150 years and still thriving in our state. Well, coming up, we're going to take a closer look at those garden plants, the flowers and the vegetables, with our guest Diana Alfoth. That's next, so stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Well, here we are in the middle of summer, and this is the time your garden should be producing flowers and a lot of vegetables, a lot of produce. It can also start to look a little neglected. And on Garden Talk today, we'll take a look at what you can do to bring those plants back to their peak form. Larry Mueller here, and my guest, Diana Alfoth, back with us from the northern part of the state. She recently retired as UW Extension Horticulture Outreach Educator for Pierce County. Been with us a number of times to talk veggies and some flowers as well. And certainly we can help with your gardening questions, and I hope you'll join in. What's going on in your garden? Give us a call. The number, 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. Diana Alfoth, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Hey, Larry. Great to be here again.
How's the season been shaping up in Pierce County this year?
Interesting, which I think it's been across the state. So we're in the far western, west central part of the state. And just like I think the rest of the state, we've had a cool, wet spring that didn't seem to want to jumpstart and get going. And then we had a warm, wet last month or two, which the warmth really made things take off. The warm season plants finally were happy and they took off. So did the weeds, and so have the diseases, and so have the insects. And so, you know, it seems like every year we start this show and we talk about the weird weather this year. But, you know, it's true. The weather is a little different every year and it presents new challenges. And obviously our gardens respond to that. I think in our area, as well as across the state, there was a lot of plants that didn't make it through winter, perennials, yeah. Trees, shrubs, and things. And I think that was more due to the dry conditions in the fall and the fact that the ground didn't freeze until later. And so the plants never went fully dormant. I think it's more drought stress than cold stress that caused that. But things that had been there for many, many, many years didn't come through. And there's sometimes just no way to fully explain it.
Yeah. In our part of the state, too, we didn't have any snow. And then we got really cold weather. And I think a lot of plants just got, the ground, the frost depth went down pretty deep compared to normal.
Yep. And I think they were already, like I said, stressed from being on the dry side. And but I will say who had a really good winter appears to be deer, because we have herd numbers like crazy, and rabbits and squirrels and all, you know, they, without that snow, I think they had good access to food. And so there seems to be more wildlife about this summer than normal.
We kind of get distracted, I guess. There's so much going on in the summer, especially this time of year. I think a lot of gardens suffer from that. What's the easiest way to keep your garden looking good?
Oh, You're right. And I think, you know, spring comes and we're all excited. We start that garden and we picture this perfect thing. But then, like you say, summers are busy. Everybody is very, very busy. And then you throw into that 90 degrees and humid when it's not really safe and healthy to be out there pulling weeds. But the weeds love that stuff. And so suddenly within a week, things are overgrown with giant ragweed and foxtail and lamb's quarters and all that stuff. And it can be really, really discouraging. And, you know, I know plenty of years when my pumpkin and squash areas never got weeded and I didn't know what was in there. And then when you finally get a frost in the fall and all the weeds die down, it's like, whoa, look, there's pumpkins and squash in there. So it can get discouraging. And so sometimes you have to just think, okay, I can't pull it all the way back to beautiful and perfect. So the biggest thing to do is that you don't want those weeds to flower and set seed, because that's weeds you'll be pulling next year. So if your weeds are taller than your beans in your garden right now, ideally, right, you would pull them. But when the weeds get so big, if you pull them up and it's next to a bean plant or a tomato plant, that root system will unearth your desired plant too. So that's hard. So one of the things that you can do is to just cut the weeds off at soil level. You don't have to necessarily get the roots out. Most of these weeds in your vegetable garden, especially, are annual weeds. So if you cut them off at soil level, that kills them. And it opens up the canopy so that your garden plants get the sun and space that they need. And so sometimes it's easier to just go in there with like some hedge trimmers or nice lopping pruner kinds of things and watch where the stems are of your crops, but just cut everything else off. If you have a big enough area, you can use a string trimmer or weed whacker. But the biggest thing is knock them down to the ground and make sure that they don't mature seeds, because once those seeds start maturing and falling to the soil level, then you've got more of these weeds next year to deal with.
Do you like, well, let's put it this way. What are your thoughts on using mulch as a weed barrier?
You know, I love mulch. And so what I do in my vegetable garden, which I've learned, because I would have that, like I say, where you can't find your pumpkin plants. So when I plant my garden, normally over the winter, I try to save up cardboard boxes, just brown corrugated cardboard. And then when spring comes and I work up my garden, I lay it all down and then I put about 6 inches of straw on top of it. And then I just leave like 5-inch circles, holes for me to plant my tomatoes and peppers and other transplants into. And I'll just leave a little, you know, 4-inch wide row space to put in beans and peas and carrots and lettuce and that sort of a thing. And that keeps all of the weed seeds that are in your soil smothered so they don't germinate. So they only germinate right in those open areas. So it massively reduces your weeding. Now this year I didn't have cardboard, but I had some really great second crop hay that didn't have any weed seeds or seed heads in it. And I put that down about 8 inches thick. And then I planted into that. There's a couple spots where some foxtail and lamb's quarters kind of poked through where it was thin, but it's still minimal weeding. Now you can't, you know, it's like, yeah, why didn't you tell me this in the spring, right? But that's the thing to do next year. But even right now, let's say you do have your weeds that have gotten too high. If you go in there and cut them off at ground level, like I just talked about, and lay down a chunk of cardboard on top of that, and then mulch. And again, it needs to be at least 4 inches deep. Sometimes people only put like an inch on it, but that disappears too fast. But that will keep the weeds from coming back, and it will, you know, get you through the second half of the season here. And so that's a way to try to reclaim your vegetable garden if it's kind of gotten a little out of control. Now, little things like carrots that are hard to find under the weeds, you know, that's just, you kind of have to get down on your hands and knees and just, you know, pick away the weeds and try to find them. There's not, you know, that's going to be harder than a bigger plant like beans and peppers and that sort of a thing. But the more you can open up that canopy and give the vegetables the light that they need, the more you're going to at least get a decent harvest.
Yeah, while you're down there on those carrots, you might want to do a little thinning. You can always eat those little carrots.
Yeah, and same with like lettuce. I have a tendency to plant my lettuce way too close and thick together, and then it just doesn't really grow well. And it's like I should know better, but I'm just kind of being lazy when I'm sprinkling that lettuce seed down.
Well, some of those seeds are pretty darn small, so it's hard.
They are. And I'm usually late getting things planted, so I'm in a hurry.
Pete and Lori from Kokana emailed to say they're having problems with their broccoli because of the last hot spell, they think. The heads grew unevenly with some leaves inside the heads, and they all smelled not good, bad. They say that the high temperatures made the heads susceptible to pathogens that attack the heads. Have you heard of this? We're hoping to get some good side shoots yet this year. Is there any way to protect the plants during a hot spell?
Yeah, and that's a common thing. Broccoli and cabbage, you know, all those plants in that family, they like the cool weather. So that's why we try to get them planted as early in the spring as possible. And typically they're done by now in the heat. And you can also be growing some from seed indoors and plant them out here in the next couple of weeks so that you get a fall harvest from them. But once that hot hits them and they bolt, okay, and the heads kind of spread all out and that sort of thing, there's really not much you can do at that point. Typically when they bolt those heads, you certainly can harvest what is there very quickly, but very often it tends to be a little more bitter. Some people will then just let them go to flower and they get the little yellow flowers, which are edible. And some people like those and, you know, put them on salads and things like that. But if you cut away that head that's there, if you have a good, different varieties of broccoli are different. Some send out side shoots better than others, but most of them will send out side shoots. So if you cut away that middle head and those flowers, hopefully you will get some good side shoots that come up that'll be able to be harvested. Now, the other thing that can happen, you know, when they say that it smells, there are a couple of diseases that hit broccoli. There's black rot and there's alternaria, and these can cause usually lesions or spots on the leaves themselves, but that can also affect the heads. And then when, you know, if you're in an area that's had rain like every day, all that water just sitting on those heads can also deteriorate them and get various things in there that start to break down those cells. And once cells start to break down, they stink, especially in something like broccoli and that. So anything that's, you know, brown and yucky, stinky, cut it away because it's never going to heal up and get better. But as far as preventing that, you know, we unfortunately haven't figured out a way to control the weather yet. But one thing that I found helped is to plant the cool season crops like the broccoli and stuff where they get the full sun, 6 hours of sun, but maybe get shade in the late afternoon when it's the hottest. So if you can put up some kind of a fence on the west side of the plants, or if you have a tree that, you know, starts to shade that area of the garden at like 3 o'clock, then you can reduce the temperature on those plants a little bit in the hottest spells, and that sometimes can help. And then finally, you know, when you're buying your broccoli, there are differences in the varieties, and sometimes maybe you have to sacrifice a little bit of, you know, the bigger head size in order to get one that's more heat tolerant. So because we do get these hot spells, and we seem to be getting more of them in summers in Wisconsin, really searching for heat-tolerant varieties of these cool-season crops is probably a good idea for everybody.
Diana Alfeth, our guest today, retired UW Extension horticulture educator for Pierce County. Great to have her with us. And you can join in. Number to call. If you got a gardening question, I hope you will. Number to call, 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. You're listening to Garden Talk here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here as we take a look at your vegetable garden, your flower garden, and other things probably as well with our guest Diana Alfeth, retired UW Extension Horticulture Outreach Specialist for Pierce County. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or email to talk@wpr.org. And let's take a call from Pam in Madison. Pam, hello. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my question. I bought cilantro, at least I thought I did, and when I got home and looked, it was celery. So I planted it in my pot, but I don't know how to take care of it. I've looked, and it says if you don't blanch it, it's bitter, and how do I take care of it?
So is it growing well?
It's growing very well because of the weather.
So you've got it in a pot, but outside?
Yes, I have like about, I think there's three or four, and they're growing just wonderfully. But then I read you had to blanch it, otherwise it was bitter. And so I'm
when you go to cook
about
it,
all this.
When you go to cook it.
If they said it's bitter if you don't blanch it.
Yeah. So in this case, it's not the cooking part, Larry, but blanching refers to like tying up the leaves and giving it some shade, so kind of like with cauliflower, so that the sun doesn't get it. But the newer varieties of celery, most of them have been bred to be what's called self-blanching, which means that, you know, the stalks like stay closer together and kind of shade themselves. So that's hopefully kind of what you have. Otherwise, celery is kind of challenging to grow. And most of us in Wisconsin never used to grow celery until they came up with the self-blanching varieties for that reason. Because otherwise you kind of have to like trench them and that sort of thing. So I wouldn't really worry too much about blanching them, because I'm hoping that yours is a self-blanching variety. So the thing is that you don't want them to get dried out. So keeping them evenly watered will make a difference. And otherwise, they're not that hard to grow. They will be susceptible to the weather. You know, the hot spells are going to take their toll on them, just like anything else. As soon as you you don't want to harvest them too soon, because those compounds will be kind of concentrated in there, and that's adds to that bitterness flavor. But otherwise, you can actually start like stealing a stalk here and there if you want it periodically. And we get into this hot weather, it's just kind of tough. So the biggest thing that you can do is, you know, if you have mulch around them to help maintain the water, making sure that they have constant water. Ideally, your soil has good organic matter. That's what they really like. And then look out for pests, because a lot of times we recommend growing celery under row covers, because there are a variety of insects and things that will get after them. And yeah, that's about it. You know, as far as blanching goes, if you want to, basically it's anything that'll keep out the light. So sometimes people would put like a thin brown paper bag over it, or some cardboard, or you know, like shade cloth, something like that. And but the thing is that you want to cover the like the stalks, but you don't want to cover the leaves, which sounds weird, but those leaves need the light in order to do photosynthesis to grow the plant. So you just kind of want to wrap around the stalks to prevent the sunlight from hitting the stalks, because that's where the bitterness would come from. So I hope that makes sense.
Pam, does that help?
Growing in a stalk, they're kind of, it's a, you know, looks really healthy. It's about 10 inches tall with leaves, and they aren't making a stalk. They're kind of like a little bush almost.
Okay. Well, they should elongate into stalks, because obviously that's what we grow celery for. Now you can, you know, harvest leaves and you'll get that celery flavor and stuff, and you can eat that too. But they should elongate as they mature. And the thing is that, you know, you don't want to over fertilize with nitrogen, because that causes a lot of leafy stuff. But you want to make sure that, you know, they do have basic nutrients. So if you haven't, you know, it's hard when you're growing in a pot, because we don't know what that soil mix is. And, you know, if you're growing things in the ground, I can say, hey, Wisconsin has fertile soils with all the nutrients, and, you know, but in a pot, the soil mix can vary dramatically. So don't overly fertilize, because that's just going to cause leaf growth, but they should be elongating and forming stalks here. As long
pretty,
as you
pretty darn soon, more. Actually, I would think.
Yeah, I'm not sure why they haven't started that yet, but, you know, summer's going so silly fast, but it is still only mid-July. Yeah. We have, you know, half the growing season to go.
All right. Pam, keep at it. Keep watching them. And thank you so much for calling. And maybe it'll turn out to be a mistake you made earlier. What was it you were trying? She was trying to buy cilantro.
Cilantro. She thought it was cilantro. So maybe, yeah, I don't know. So I'm one of those that I know a lot of people that hate cilantro, and it tastes like soap to me. So I would never even consider buying cilantro, whereas my brother puts it on absolutely everything. So maybe, you know, taste a few of those bushy leaves and make sure if it tastes like celery or cilantro, because maybe there's, yeah.
I'd take a taste of one of the leaves just to see. That's what I do.
Because the leaves do look somewhat similar, so yeah.
There you go. Thank you, Pam, for calling. You can join in too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Well, water's come up a few times in the show, and the need for regular watering, but I gotta say, I have not had to do very darn much watering this year, and my friends say the same thing.
Right, and honestly, I think people overwater their gardens more than underwater their gardens. I haven't watered my garden since I first planted it. And once things are in there for 2 weeks, the seeds have germinated or transplants have been in there 2 weeks, they're established enough in, and again, I use, you know, some mulch, but I haven't watered at all. And I, you know, I talk to a lot of people who have a lot of disease issues and things. Some people will have plants that wilt in the afternoon. So they water them every day, but they're wilting because they're overwatered. And if you overwater, you have a small root system. And so then in the heat of the afternoon, that small root system can't take up enough water to support the plant. So it starts to wilt. So then you feel you got to water, and it's a vicious cycle. But if you're growing in containers in pots, you absolutely probably have to water them every day. And if it's a 90 degree and day and those pots are in the sun, you might need to water them morning and night. But if you're growing in the ground, there is no way that you should water your garden more than once every 3 or 4 days, even on a sandy soil, because the soil where the roots are 4, 5, 6 inches down absolutely simply cannot dry out that fast. And think about all the, you know, the trees and the shrubs and the, you know, wild plants around. They're not, if it doesn't rain, they're not getting watered every day. And it's the same with your garden plants, even the annual plants and the vegetables. If you, you really should check the soil before you water. Stick your finger down in the soil and it should be dry an inch down before you water. And if you're watering automatically every day, I see people post online that, oh, this hot weather, I'm watering my garden twice a day. You're causing more harm than good. That's going to make diseases and insects happy. And too much water is just as stressful, if not more stressful, than not enough water. And so I will say that we make hay for our horses, and we have not had a 4-day stretch without rain.
Yeah.
since May. and that's been frustrating. And so if that's the case, there's no reason to be giving your garden supplemental water. So I would really encourage people to back off on watering. I just think, it causes a lot of problems. Certainly you don't want your plants to get drought stressed, but there's a lot of overwatering going on.
Okay. Let's go to Michael in Cross Plains. Hi, Michael.
Hey, I was calling a bit with a comment about the previous caller on celery.
Yeah.
I'm a vegetable farmer. I was just listening while I was driving my tractor. And I was thinking, you know, maybe it's possible that that celery plant is actually a celery root if it's not forming a thick stalk. I just thought I would put that comment out there.
Oh.
That's an interesting concept. I hadn't thought of that. There are, celery root that's grown for the bulb, the root kind of thing. So, Yeah, and if it was mislabeled and it was supposed to be cilantro, there's no way to go back and look at that label. But, interesting idea.
Yeah, thanks, Michael. How's your work going in Cross Plains?
Well, we were just planting some cover crops right up until about 10 minutes ago when we started getting rained on.
Oh.
There you go.
Michael.
Which is great for germinating those seeds and stuff. So,
yeah.
Lucky you.
Thanks, Michael, for calling. Appreciate it. Well, let's go to Chris in Madison next. Hi, Chris.
Hi there. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. I'm standing out in the rain in my yard in Madison. so not far from Cross Plains. I have two questions. One is about raspberries. I was given a raspberry transplant a couple years ago. Put it in a good spot. It's thriving, but it's not blossoming or putting out fruit. And this is like the second or maybe third year. So my question is, should I give up on that and buy new raspberry starts? And my second question is about splitting and transplanting perennials. When is the earliest that I could start doing that?
Okay, well, let's take your second question first. So right now is the worst time to be transplanting perennials. If you buy perennials like from a nursery and they've been in a pot for a while, you can definitely plant them at any time because you have the whole root system. But anytime you transplant perennials, you disturb the roots, you rip off a whole bunch of them, you leave a whole bunch behind. And then when you move them, it has a compromised root system, and so it can't take up water as efficiently. And this being the hottest time of the year, they will suffer. Now, I'm not saying you can't do it. I've done it, especially with things like hosta or shade plants or daylilies, which are really hard to kill, they will get very dramatic. They'll droop. They'll look horrible the rest of this year. But the root system, as long as you keep it watered, will survive and grow next year. So if you absolutely had to move them now, you could take a chance. But ideally, you're going to wait until the weather is a little bit cooler. So normally, we're talking maybe at least a month from now. So late August and early September is usually the best time for transplanting perennials. Now, the one caveat to that is the if it blooms in the fall, transplant it in the spring. If it blooms in the spring, transplant it in the fall, because the blooming process takes a lot of energy from the plant. And so it's not a great idea to transplant anything when it's in bud or blossom. So that would be that. The raspberry question is a little trickier, because raspberries have a lot of little quirks that seem to cause problems. So raspberries grow from the root. They grow a stalk, and that's called the primocane. And then the second year that primocane grows more and becomes a floricane, that's what flowers and produces the berries. And then that cane dies. Okay, now there are ever-bearing raspberries and fall-bearing raspberries. And so that complicates things a little bit more, because we don't know exactly what you have. But if you stick a raspberry root in the ground and you never prune it, eventually it should be sending up stalks within 3 years that would become floricanes and actually bloom. So if you've done any pruning away or not, or nipping off the tops of any of those, that could be why you haven't gotten flowers or berries yet. But the other thing is, we never recommend getting raspberry plants from somebody else, because raspberries are susceptible to a whole bunch of little viruses and stuff that can get into them. And so I know my mom had a raspberry patch that went for, 25 years, and it was still producing. But some years it would look kind of mangy, and other years it would look better. Generally speaking, the recommendations are that you eliminate and restart a raspberry patch every 15 years because of the viruses that build up in it. And those viruses can cause things like misshapen fruit and small fruit or no fruit. So there's always a chance that what you got from a friend had viruses in it, and that's why it's not going well. Otherwise, they do need full sun, so hopefully they get at least 6 hours of full sun, because that will also make them not flower. If you top dress, like with some compost, make sure that you give them some fertilizer in the spring when the growth starts going, they should otherwise be flowering. So don't prune anything. Give them fertilizer in the spring. You can wait and see. Or if you want to replace, buy raspberries from a nursery where they've been certified virus-free.
All right. Chris, you got some thinking there. She doesn't know if it's been 2 or 3 years on the, those plants. You could wait till next year, or the sure thing.
I'd probably give them another year. And like I said, be sure that you don't prune anything off, because, theoretically you can get into pruning where you prune them halfway down and then the floricane, but I don't want to complicate things for her, because you should still get some berries even if you don't do any pruning. So I'd leave them alone, see what happens.
Yeah.
But I will say that the black raspberries, the wild things, the black caps and stuff this year are in full production right now around here. And the berries are huge this year because of all this rain that we've gotten. So that's the that's another upside to all the wet weather.
Chris, there you go. You got some thinking to do there. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. JC in Wautoma, we'll go to you now. Hi, JC.
Hello. I have a question about the raspberries. I have ever-bearing raspberries, I applied some 10-10-10 fertilizer a couple weeks ago, and the fertilizer had been soaked. I'm wondering if that did any damage to the raspberries.
So you had granular that you soaked?
Hello?
You had granular fertilizer and you soaked the granular?
Yes, it had gotten soaked in the rain.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Okay, before you put it on?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So it certainly didn't harm the raspberries any. But when fertilizer gets wet, a lot of times, especially the nitrogen in it, can be released and depleted some. So you might not have gotten the full bang for the buck on that fertilizer, but it certainly wouldn't hurt the raspberries any. I would not reapply at this time because now is not the time to be fertilizing. So if you, at this point, I would wait till like next spring when growth first starts before trying to fertilize again. And that's a really good point to make. So right now, after June 21st, when the days start getting shorter, we think, hey, now this is the middle of summer, this is great, but the plants are actually already starting to think about winter. So the decreasing day length triggers them to think about getting ready for winter. And so perennial plants, trees and shrubs and stuff, they will stop putting on new growth and they start thinking about sending the energy down to the roots to store for winter. So we do not want to fertilize perennial plants after like at least July 1st, if not a little sooner than that, because fertilizer pushes growth and it encourages growth. And we don't want them growing at this time of year because we don't want them growing on the top. We want them worrying about the roots and preparing for winter. Plants need the nutrients when they're putting on their flush of growth. So in raspberries' case, that's right after winter when those canes start leafing out and new canes start shooting up from the root system. So in your vegetable garden, if you wanted to put a little more nitrogen on your onions right now, I'd be okay with that. But pretty much everything else, you know, like even your like tomatoes and peppers, you don't want to be adding fertilizer anymore because they should be concentrating on producing fruits, not leaves or top growth. And like I said, you might have lost a little bang for your buck on that fertilizer, but it won't have hurt the raspberries any.
There you go, JC. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Diana Alfeth, our guest today, UW Extension retired horticulture outreach specialist. I'm Larry Mehler for Garden Talk on WPR News. Taking a look at your garden today with Diana Alfeth, Larry Mehler here. Thanks for joining in today. Questions? Give a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk at WPR.org. Number of emails, Shirley emailed that her phlox gets yellow every summer. What's up with that and how can she prevent it?
So phlox are susceptible to several diseases, most of them fungal diseases, depending on your variety. So the older varieties especially would be really susceptible to powdery mildew. In that case, the leaves will eventually turn kind of white and fuzzy looking, but they can, some yellowing can be another symptom of some powdery mildew. I did see the pictures, and there's a lot of like brown crispiness on the edges of her leaves too, which makes me think that that may very well be something like anthracnose or some other fungal disease. And we're starting to really see a lot of that on a lot of plants right now, again, because of the water, the rain, the wetness that we've had, especially in springtime when it was kind of, we know we had a lot of cool weather that encourages some of these fungal things, but the leaves get infected and the fungi are living on these leaves and stuff, but they still look green to us, but then eventually the cells collapse and then we see the brown. So even though we're seeing the brown and the yellowing now, that infection occurred, you know, 6 weeks ago or whatever. So bottom line is I think you've got some fungal things going on, once you see symptoms, you can never cure that. So you can't take a brown leaf and turn it back to green. You might be able to stop the progression if it's something that's progressing by using a fungicide. But very often, because the weather conditions change, we get into warmer weather, usually drier weather, then conditions aren't right for the fungus, so it doesn't start to progress. So there's no, you know, there's no value in treating it. The way to know for sure would be to send a sample of your phlox into the plant disease diagnostics clinic down at the U of the UW and get it tested to find out for sure what you're dealing with. Because if you get this problem every year, that means that you're probably going to continue to get it every year. And knowing exactly what pathogen is causing the problems will tell you for sure how to treat it. Otherwise, generally speaking, I would say if you can open up air circulation around there as much as possible so that it dries out more, you can treat with, remember that fungicides are preventatives, they're not cures. So if you have a plant that gets a fungal disease every year, you're going to want to put that fungicide on before you start seeing symptoms. But again, getting a test to know exactly which pathogen you're dealing with will tell you the best way to treat it and deal with it in the future. If you're buying phlox now to put in your garden or any other kind of plant, you know, the best advice is always to read the label and pick the one that says disease resistant mm-hmm. because they've bred phlox to be more disease resistant, but not all varieties are.
Matthew in Madison has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Matthew.
Hey, Larry. My question I'm wondering about is I have some tomato plants and cucumber plants in garden boxes in my backyard, and I had mixed topsoil and some peat moss together. I think that because the peat moss is pretty like water absorbent. And so I'm just wondering like how much of a positive effect peat moss can have when mixed with topsoil and like what a good mix ratio might be. I was just kind of guessing when I did it.
So peat moss is great because it, as you said, it holds moisture. It's organic matter. The challenge with peat moss is that it's a very low pH. It's down in the fours in most cases. And most of our garden plants want, like tomatoes and cucumbers, they would love their growing medium pH to be maybe like 6.8, something, you know, in that area. So when you guess and you, you know, put those things together, it's really, really hard to say what the ratio should be because we don't know what the pH of the topsoil is either. And so if that's also a low pH, you could end up with a growing medium that's a little bit low on the pH side. So we don't recommend, you know, doing like 50-50 on the peat moss kind of a thing because unless you're growing blueberries, because of that pH question. You can always take a sample, send it to the soil lab, have them tested. I really don't recommend the little over-the-counter at the garden center test tube pH things and stuff because I don't think they're accurate. And you're going to spend as much on one of those kits as you would by sending the sample into the actual professional soil lab. So $15 is a great investment. But otherwise, it's hard to say a perfect ratio because the topsoil mix that you have could have a higher or lower organic matter content. And so, you know, it's just impossible to say, you know, 60-40, 50-50, whatever. There's just so much variability depending on what it is that you have. But your plants are in there this year. And so you could send a sample in to see what the pH is, or you could like wait until the end of the year or early spring and send in a sample and see where you're at. They can test for organic matter content and pH and your nutrient levels, and then you would be all set for next year.
Matthew, there you go. Thank you for calling. Karen in Wausau has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Karen.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question about beefsteak tomato plants. And we've always gotten our plants from a reputable greenhouse. And we have about 9 plants, and they're in a raised bed. And they're probably about 4 feet tall, and there isn't one blossom on any of them. So it's a little frustrating because it's getting a little late. So there's no sign of any tomato at all on any of them.
Okay. So there's a couple of things that can cause this. One would be excessive nitrogen fertilizer. So if you over-fertilize them, a lot of times that causes a lot of leaves, and they don't think about blossoming. But also what's happened this year is tomatoes, they like warm weather, but they don't like hot weather. And once it gets like above 86 degrees or so, they're stressed just like we are. But of course, they don't get to go into the air conditioning. But that will cause them to stop or abort their flower. So they might have been starting flower buds, and then they got a heat spell and they just aborted the flowers. And so it's just going to take a little bit of time for them to reset and try again. I'm assuming that you've got them in full sun, 6 to 8 hours of full sun, because you've grown them before. And the other things that can cause aborted flower buds are floods, or more likely overwatering than underwatering, because tomatoes are shockingly drought tolerant. But otherwise, you know, it's kind of like, yeah, it's maybe getting late, but in summer, tomatoes can catch up really fast. So I wouldn't worry yet. And I hate to be the broken record of, oh, just blame it on the weather, right? But that is what we do, right? When we don't have an answer, we blame it on the weather. But the flowers may have aborted due to the weather.
And you may, yeah, and if it all doesn't work, you've got the farmers markets in the fall.
That's right.
I used to grow lots of tomatoes, and I would make a sort of a V8 type tomato juice. I'd make 50 quarts a year. And I had a big garden then. And I finally got tired of having to, you know, every night be out there making V8 tomato juice. I finally decided to go to the farmer's market and buy the tomatoes and do it all in one shoot.
There is truth to that. You know, you can get them all at once. You can go to the market and talk to a farmer and order a bushel ahead of time or whatever, and get them when it's convenient for you. And you know, that's kind of a good way to go sometimes.
Ellie in Middleton emailed. She has 2 huge rhubarb plants she'd like to split or divide. When and how should she do that in our last minute or so here?
So kind of like what I said earlier, right now is not the time because it's too hot. But you can do it in early spring or late fall. So if you wait till spring, do it just before the new growth begins. So if you're just starting to see a little bit of stuff sticking out of the soil, otherwise you can do it this fall in I like to say Labor Day is the time to start laboring with your plant divisions and transplanting. And that would be the time, just get them watered in. Don't fertilize them until spring, just because, again, we don't want to be encouraging any kind of top growth. But once it's September, you can dig out what you want, move it. Some people like to trim off the leaves, but I like to leave any kind of leaves that are green, because that's how the plant gets its energy, by doing photosynthesis. But if leaves are yellowish or, you know, really off color, they're not going to be doing
take
much photosynthesis.
Off.
So then you can take them off. But do it after Labor Day.
Always a pleasure, Diana. Thank you so much for being with us today. We'll look forward to your next visit. Thank you.
Sounds good, Larry. Have a great day.
Diana Alf is retired UW Extension Horticulture Outreach Specialist for Pierce County. We'll have her back and we'll do this again. Next week, Bruce Spangenberg will be with us from UW Extension. And so we'll look forward to that as well. And boy, thank you so much for joining us today. And thanks to our team for creating our shows. Our team, Clara Kniper, Joel Patnod, Lee Rayburn, and Jeff Robbins. Our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Always a lot of fun for me. I hope it's been for you, and I hope you'll stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.